So if we're actually growing as human beings, we should be able to point back to multiple things that we concretely got wrong or were just wrong about. And that is uncomfy to think through. So, you know, and it's so uncomfortable, a lot of us just don't want to face it.
Hey there, I'm Julie. Welcome to Uncomfy, a podcast about sticking with moments that challenge us. We share stories of real people in moments that challenge their perspective. And instead of getting angry or shutting down, they stuck with the discomfort. They stayed curious and they stayed open, and they're glad they did. We hope these stories inspire you to stick with it too, because there is so much to gain. New empathy, deeper relationships, more clarity about our own views. I'm glad you're here. Now, let's get uncomfy. Here's a story about admitting you were wrong in front of the whole world. I'm joined by David French. He's an opinion columnist for the New York Times, where he writes about law, culture, religion, and armed conflict. He's also author of the book Divided We Fall. David, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for taking time today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I just have to say that you have been top of my list for quite some time when it comes to this podcast, because I see you on a near daily basis and at least several times a week in the New York Times taking positions that bring quite a bit of, that requires some humility on your part, but also, you know, to go very public about some of your viewpoints is probably always uncomfortable on some level.
Well, absolutely. You know, one of the things that I think when you're talking about my job as a columnist, how do you build trust with your audience? And a lot of people sort of think, well, you have to build trust by just always being right. Well, you're not always going to be right. You're going to get some things wrong. So I try to build trust by being transparent, by saying, here's what I think, here's where I come from, here's why I think it. And then if my views change on something, if I have new information, I want to say, hey, my views have changed. Here's the new information. Or if I make a prediction and the prediction turns out to be wrong, I want to take ownership of that and say, here's why, you know, this is wrong. And I think that people all in the long run find that more valuable, because in the reality, they don't think of a columnist or a pundit or whatever you want to call me as infallible. They want to know you as thoughtful. Those are different things. You know, now, if you're thoughtful and always wrong about stuff, that's a problem. But they mainly want you to be thoughtful, not infallible. And so, and to my mind, that means show your work. And so that's what I try to do.
I appreciate that. And it's evident in your work. I'd love to have you tell us a story about a particularly, I guess, uncomfy experience you've had showing your work publicly.
Yeah. So, well, let's go back to 2014. And in 2014, there was this horrible incident that occurred in Ferguson, Missouri. And this is when Michael Brown, a man named Michael Brown, was involved in an altercation with a police officer, and he was shot and killed. And folks may remember this, the hands up, don't shoot. The argument was that an officer shot him when he was in a vulnerable position with his hands up and surrender. A bunch of riots erupted as a result of that. The Black Lives Matter movement sort of began as a movement roughly around this time as well. So I'm writing about this. At the time, I was not yet a full-time journalist when this occurred, but I was writing for National Review off and on. But by the time I became a full-time journalist in May of 2015, the issues surrounding police shootings and the issues surrounding, you know, the criminal justice around police shootings was top of mind in America. And I had always grown up a kind of law and order conservative, you know, traditional sort of Reagan law and order conservative. I had a little bit of a libertarian streak to me, but I'd not really thought through the implications in the realm of law and order. And so I was instinctively protective of cops. That was just sort of dispositionally in my nature, instinctively protective. And then also, by the time this happened, I had been practicing as a constitutional lawyer for 20 years. So I was dispositionally supportive of law enforcement. I had a long history of practicing constitutional law. And I could see the problems with some of the narrative around the Michael Brown shooting immediately. And so I leapt to the defense of the police in that circumstance. There was rioting. I don't like rioting, still don't. Was condemning the rioting and sort of was writing off a lot of the anger at the incident improperly as sort of a product of a lot of misinformation. And so I had some thoughtful people come to me and say, David, you really need to think through this issue a little more carefully, because the Michael Brown shooting, yeah, I'm with you. And as the Obama Department of Justice later investigated and found out that that was not, the hands up, don't shoot narrative was false. I believe Politico called it one of the lies of the year that year, that didn't occur. So yeah, I was right to be skeptical of that shooting, but they said, hey, take a look at this issue more broadly. And look at it with an open mind more broadly. And so that was what I began to do, really starting in 2015, 2016, as other shootings occurred and other disturbing incidents occurred.
Yeah, and could I pause you for that for a moment there? That this seems like a pivotal moment where someone approaches you with, I mean, maybe it was gentle chastisement, but it was like, I think you might be getting this wrong. I think you need to think about this maybe a little more deeply. How did that feel to you?
Well, you know, you're constantly getting negative feedback when you're writing in public. So I'm very used to getting critique. I'm very used to people saying this is wrong for these reasons. Not all of them are equally meritorious, right? Not all the critiques are delivered in good faith. Not all the critiques are very good or sound or logical. But I made a commitment to myself when I started writing that I wanted to be open to good faith critique. I knew, you know, look, I'm a fallen human being. I'm not perfect. And so if I'm going to put myself in public as somebody who's writing with some authority on legal, political, cultural matters, I need to be open to good faith criticism, because I'm just going to get some stuff wrong. And so I had made a pre-existing commitment to be open to good faith criticism. But then what really helped me on this was somebody said to me something very interesting that I took to heart. And they said, David, we know you have a lot of experience dealing with the use of force because you were in Iraq. Here's what I'm going to ask you to do. Look at these incidents through the standpoint of your experience with the use of force in Iraq and see if what is happening in some of the streets of American cities, see how that matches with the discipline or the restraint or whatever that you saw in an actual war zone. And that piqued my interest because, you know, they were saying, hey, you have some unique experience here that you could bring to bear on this discussion. And then also there's a sign of sort of respect that says, hey, I believe you're a serious person. And I think as a serious person, you will find this interesting, which is a much better way of approaching somebody than saying, you're just getting this all wrong, you idiot. So then you're immediately in that defensive crouch. But if someone says to you, hey, you know, I've long respected your work. I've long respected the process you bring to it. Why don't you plug this new information to that process and see where you come out? I mean, that just absolutely connected in a way that really did make me sort of do the work.
And for viewers and listeners who aren't familiar with your military history, you were in Iraq.
So during 07 and 08, I was serving with the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment in Diyala Province in eastern Iraq, very near the Iranian border. And one of my jobs was to help the commander make these shoot, don't shoot, bomb, don't bomb decisions. And I also had to evaluate the use of force. So people would accuse our soldiers of violating the laws of war, and I would have to make these kinds of determinations and help the command make these kinds of determinations. And so I spent an entire year in a war zone, sometimes going out there on patrol myself, for example, making a decision as to whether a use of force was appropriate or not. And here's the key, Julie, because this is going to get really, really important the more we discuss this. The use of force in war, in an actual counterinsurgency wartime setting. And so what the argument was made to me was, David, you will find that American police officers actually sometimes use less restraint in the use of force than American soldiers do in a war. And I found that assertion to be surprising, right? Surprising. But then as I began to look at the more of this body camera footage that's out there, as I began to dive more into a lot of these cases that were being prosecuted, I realized that there were multiple occasions in which American police officers in the streets of the United States of America were pulling the trigger faster than American soldiers would pull the trigger in Iraq, which is something that when I say that out loud, a lot of people say, no way, seriously? No way. But yes, 100% correct. And then I began to dive more into some of the legal doctrines. Why is this the case? And I began to discover that there was a combination of a legal doctrine and a psychological issue, sort of, for lack of a better term, but sort of a cultural slash psychological issue when it comes to juries and how juries interact with police officers. So we had both some problems with the law and some problems with how juries interact with police officers that were creating, on sort of building on top of each other, a world in which, quite literally, police officers in certain circumstances were more willing to use force in an American city than American soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan were willing to use force in an actual war zone. And that, for me, was striking. And that's when I began to write about this more and more. And I wrote a piece in 2018, 4 years later, that was why I changed my mind about police, writing about police shootings.
And so what was the gist of that that article that you wrote? And what did it feel like for you to kind of put that on paper?
Oh, man, I knew people were going to get upset at this. Because there are certain topics that when you write about it, you know people are going to get volcanically angry. Abortion, of course. Israel-Palestine, of course. Race and criminal justice, another huge one. Like, people get very, 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 very angry. And so what I wanted to be very careful. I wanted to say, look, when I'm writing about this, I'm not indicting the police as an institution, sweeping indictment. There are tons of really good police officers. There's tons. But the combination of law and culture has meant that we have too many bad police officers, and those bad police officers have too much legal protection. And so that creates problems in American society because, yeah, we have lots of good policing. Thank God for it. I'm very grateful for their courage. I'm very grateful for their service. But we also just have too many cops who do the wrong things and too little accountability. And it creates a culture of impunity. And so I tried to be very careful, and I tried to say, this is what I thought, this is what changed my thinking, and here's where I currently am. Because I didn't want to I think I was in one extreme, which was my default position is that, you know, I'm going to be instinctively defensive of cops. I didn't want to go to the other extreme, which is my default position is to be instinctively indicting cops, you know. The defund the police argument and whatever from day one had no purchase with me. But what's the golden mean here? What's the actual true reality as opposed to stampeding to one extreme or the other? And that's where I landed on sort of the basic fundamental sort of golden mean. The true north was we have systems that protect bad cops inappropriately. And those systems mean that bad cops will inflict real harm on the American public, and we need to change those systems if we want to minimize that harm. So that's where I ended up.
And so what's it like for you then to go back and read the stuff you wrote about these issues prior?
Cringe.
Really?
Cringe. Okay. You know, it's always difficult to understand when you are wrong, right? That's a hard thing. You know, there's this sort of theological concept called sanctification, which is sort of the slow process of becoming a better person over the course of your life. So all of us, hopefully by the time I'm 90, if Lord willing, I live to be 90, hopefully I'm a better person than I am right now when I'm 55. And at 55, I want to be a better person than I was when I was 35 or 25 or 15. So if we're actually growing as human beings, we should be able to point back to multiple things that we concretely got wrong or were just wrong about. And that is uncomfy to think through. So, you know, and it's so uncomfortable, a lot of us just don't want to face it. And it's in a very real way, it's almost like we'd rather be wrong and not face the shame than be right and fully acknowledge sort of the shame of being wrong. And so, you know, I feel like a lot of it, you just got to own it. You just have to own it.
I'd love advice on that. Because in addition, and I do want to just mention, too, that you actually are quite, not just on this topic, but you've been very open about, you know, the ways in which you've changed your ways over time. You talk openly about having been a real partisan political ideologue for, you know, a period of your life up until about a decade ago. And now you spend a lot of time. In fact, you were just recently at Brigham Young University offering a forum, you know, a forum speech in which you were encouraging people to be civil and be open and be humble and be forgiving and kind of all those things. Right. So, how do you sort of deal with the embarrassment and the shame of, like, realizing that you were misguided or that you've changed, you're a better person, and sort of, like, not feel that anymore and just kind of move forward as a better person?
Well, so I think there's a couple of things. One, you feel it. There's no way to not feel it, right? So that feeling of that embarrassment, feeling of that shame, I think there's just no way to go through that other than just pushing through and realizing, okay, I have to own this. I was wrong. And saying you're wrong means taking your lumps a little bit, including in the court of public opinion. But a lot of it is really who, let me get kind of meta here. You know, there's this phrase that is like sort of, who, what is the audience that you are living for, right? Who, and there's this phrase, the audience of one, which is, in other words, like, I'm trying to do, as a Christian person, I'm trying to live in a way that pleases God first and foremost. If you can please men, fine, so long as it's actually in connection with doing God's will. But my objection, my object in life is not pleasing men, right? That's not the fundamental object of my life. I'm trying to live in service to Jesus, and that means pleasing Jesus. And so if you have that as your fundamental goal, then repentance is going to be just it's going to have to be a lifelong practice of recognizing error, repenting, and changing. Recognize error, repent, and turn. If you understand who is it you're living for, what is it are you that you're living for, that really can be very deeply clarifying. And a lot of people go off the rails when they say, well, I'm living for acclaim and I'm working towards, you know, popularity or wealth or whatever. That's going to send you down a ton of compromising paths. But if you're living in service of Jesus and you're seeking to, you know, to do his will, that's a different kind of analysis, because one of the things that he says is take up your cross and follow me. So if you're doing his will, you're going to face adversity. You're going to face difficult moments. And now some of those difficult moments will be because of me, because of the mistakes that I made, right? But I think if you live your life with a position that I'm trying to become more like Jesus, that means I'm going to have to be growing, and growing is painful. So it, you know, over time in your life, the rubber does really meet the road sometimes, and you have to, you know, what's that phrase? Choose this day whom you will serve.
Yeah. David French, if I could ask you, what is the uncomfy conversation or exploration that you think more Americans need to be having right now at this moment, after a very divisive presidential election in a very deeply politically polarized landscape? What do you hope we're doing as we engage with one another and with our own ideas?
You know, I'm going to do the cheesiest thing possible, and I'm just going to quote, I'm going to quote Ted Lasso. Be curious. There are a lot of Americans who've just finished making decisions that about half the country hates. So you have a situation where two Americans have received more than 70 million votes in a bitterly divided country. So it's just simply wrong to look at all of those people on the other side and say, well, they're just all misguided, bad, wrong, terrible, awful. I need to protect myself from them, versus, wow, 71 million or 74 million fellow Americans made a really different decision from me. Why? And now, for some people, you will ask the question why, and the answer that you'll get will be ugly. You won't like it, that it is bad, that maybe they do actually hate me. Maybe they do actually think I'm a horrible person. Maybe they do have malicious intentions in some way. But an awful lot of the people, when you ask that question, you're going to get an answer back that humanizes them, that helps you understand where they're coming from, that destroys your own stereotypes and preconceptions. when I spoke at BYU, one of the things I spoke about was that a lot of times we're just wrong about our political opponents. We think that they're one thing and they're another thing entirely. So one of my foremost pieces of advice going forward, be curious. When you encounter somebody who has a diametrically opposed views from you, be curious as the default. That's the first priority beyond setting them straight. Because everyone walks into those situations and they say, well, I just ran into someone who disagrees with me. I need to set them straight. Start with the priority of curiosity. Then you can have the argument after your curiosity.
David French is an opinion columnist for The New York Times. He's author of Divided We Fall, America's Secession Threat and How to Restore Our Nation. David, it has been a real pleasure. Thank you for taking time today.
Thanks so much, Julie, for having me. It's been a real treat.
And thank you for getting uncomfy with us today. I know it feels like we are all trying to decide on a daily basis which uncomfy conversations to have and which ones to skip. I would love to hear how you're navigating that. Send me an email, uncomfy@byu.edu. Now, uncomfy moments don't always lead to you or somebody else changing their mind. But if you have a story like David's where you ended up reevaluating your own view on something as a result of an uncomfy moment, I would love to hear about it as well. Again, our email is uncomfy@byu.edu. By the way, if you would like to watch the speech David French gave recently at BYU about why America is so polarized and what he thinks we can do about it, we'll link to that in the show notes. And be sure to check out my other podcast, Top of Mind, where we're looking for nuanced perspectives to help us think through tough topics. Just look for Top of Mind with Julie Rose on your favorite podcast app. Uncomfy is a BYU radio podcast. Samuel Benson produces it, and the team includes Enrique Prado, James Hoops, and Sam Payne. Our theme music was composed by Kelsey Ney. I'm Julie Rose. Can't wait to get uncomfy with you again next week. Hey, friends, if you are on the lookout for another awesome podcast, check out Constant Wonder. It's also from the BYU Radio Network. It's hosted by my friend Marcus Smith. And it is like embarking on an exhilarating journey through captivating stories about our magnificent natural world. As you listen, you'll gain profound insights into different facets of our planet. You'll discover more about nature. I've learned about whales and bees and nematodes from listening to Constant Wonder. And you might even find yourself pondering your own connection to the wonders of this earth. So wherever you usually get your podcasts, do yourself a favor and go check out Constant Wonder from BYU Radio.